You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. How do we perceive the world? Moreover, how do we perceive the world we see every day during our daily commute or our neighborhood walk? How much do we see and hear? And how much do we ignore? Well, these are the questions that intrigue my guest today. Alexandra Horowitz is a cognitive scientist and a professor of psychology at Barnard College, whose previous book, Inside of a Dog, was a bestseller and offered insights into the perceptual world of the canine. Her latest book examines our own perception and what we overlook in the everyday. Her new book, On Looking, 11 Walks with Expert Eyes, involves neighborhood walks with an array of specialists, a geologist, a typographer, an illustrator, a naturalist, a wildlife researcher, an urban sociologist, a doctor, a blind woman, a sound designer, as well as her toddler son and her family dog. She found many new ways of seeing the familiar and began to perceive new worlds right in her own neighborhood. The name of the book is On Looking. Alexandra Horowitz is our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Alexandra Horowitz, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Rich.
On Looking started out, I guess, as a result of your last book of observing how your dog observed its world and how it observed walk time.
Yeah.
And then you began thinking, says, well, what are the things the dog is seeing that I'm not, and what are things other people are seeing that I'm not, and it got into a whole discussion of how we observe the world.
Yeah, you've got it. I was turned on to the fact that I'm missing most of what could be seen on a walk by looking through my dog's perception, essentially, trying to see what she saw and realizing how much I missed. And then I took a whole bunch of other walks, basically around ordinary blocks in my city, but in other cities as well, trying to see what other people saw.
You start off by talking about the whole idea of attention and selective attention. From an evolutionary standpoint, how are humans predisposed to see the world? What are we good at blocking out, and what are we good at seeing? I would assume threats would be one thing.
Yeah, exactly. That's where it starts. We're pretty good at blocking out everything that's the same. In other words, if something is the same as it was yesterday when you walk out your door, you don't really need to notice it. But if instead of your car, it's a tiger, that's a good thing to notice, right? And that's how we survived. Those people who could make that distinction survive, you could put it that way. And so we notice the new thing. But we don't notice the ordinary things. And a lot in our life is pretty ordinary, and that's okay. We don't want to be on alert all the time, noticing everything around us all the time. But it's nice to remember that if we just turn our attention to it, there's some really interesting things to be seen in some landscape that we dismissed already as familiar.
You know, I wonder how many people actually do take time to just say, look at the ordinary and maybe try to observe something different about the ordinary. Because I know I'll be driving home and there'll just be this absolutely gorgeous sunset, and yet we're all driving home. I'm kind of trying to peek as I'm driving home to see the sunset because it is absolutely gorgeous outside. And yet all these other cars are just going on about their business. And it's like, I often wonder, are they doing the same thing I'm doing, sort of peeking out of the side to sort of be in the moment as you're doing other activities, or are they just going about their business?
Well, I think you're right. Not a lot of them are peeking to look at it. And we've gotten so distracted and caught up in all the entertainments, you know, and our phone or our errands, and et cetera, that we aren't looking even at the sky, right? You have a great big sky where you live, and it's beautiful almost all the time. It's interesting. But we really don't look up. I think we tend to compartmentalize and make vacations the time we go, you know, really look around and see something new, you know, or go to a foreign country and, oh, look how interesting everything is. Well, that, you know, where we live is somebody else's vacation. It's as interesting. It's just that we're not looking at it.
And after taking these 11 walks with different peoples, do you feel like you're experiencing a new world in your ordinary world every day?
I do. I'd say every day I see something I hadn't seen before, and nothing's profound, but it's just something different, a slightly different vantage, and it's really refreshing to be able to see that. I mean, of course, I still also just drive, you know, where I need to go or walk where I need to go in a hurry, and there are plenty of times I'm not looking. There's no mandate to be looking all the time. It's appropriate that we tune that out sometimes, but it's really nice to remember that we can turn it on, and I turn that muscle on. It's like a muscle, really, every day.
Well, let's talk about some of the walks you took. And the first was with your son, who's a toddler.
He was 19 months at the time, and now he's 3. And anyone who has been around children or has children or was a child themselves might remember that when you're that age, you don't know about the world yet. You know, you don't know how the world was organized. And it was very interesting to let him lead me on the walk and see what was interesting to him, because he doesn't see things as defined already, as put into little places. These things are interesting, these things are not. You know, a paper bag that's being tossed down the street in the wind is interesting and funny and exciting to him, whereas to me it's just trash and I don't even look, right? And so to look at the world through his perspective is to be entertained once again, to remember that there was one point where we didn't know what all this was.
Right. And that's it. The other interesting thing is, you know, as those first 5 years or six years, you know, that sack blowing down the street might be new and interesting from a novel point of view of never seeing a sack blow down the street. Or it could, you know, once the imagination starts gearing in and there are more connections going on, all of a sudden that sack can be something completely different than what it is and still be interesting to the child.
Yeah, precisely.
Yeah,
and we know they see a lot of life in what we see as inanimate things, too. So they're starting to use words and think maybe that paper bag is being silly, you know, or maybe it's being chased. And suddenly there are all these possible dimensions. It's a very playful way to look at the world. Whereas for me, it was just this low note of trash that somebody had
come
dropped.
On, let's go. Let's go look at something interesting.
Hurry.
Yeah,
that's right. Right. And of course, you get nowhere on walks like this, but you have a much more enjoyable time.
Now, your son was intrigued by, I guess he was making the O sound and he was recognizing the letter.
That's right. Right. Of course, lots of things are circles in the natural environment.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, part of an iron grate or part of an air conditioning unit or whatever it was. And so he was just starting to identify that that was an interesting letter and shape in the world. And so he was finding it everywhere. And, you know, you could look for the whole alphabet if you wanted to, and maybe that's not going to engage most adults all the time. But it's interesting to remember that it's not just an air conditioning unit. It's something made up of a lot of little O's. And that's another way to look at it.
And as he would walk along, of course, he's walking at a really slow pace. He's stopping at things that don't necessarily interest you. Give us the interaction between you and your child as he's looking at things that you would normally overlook.
It took me a minute to usually see what he was seeing, actually, because you have to unpack so much of how we ordinarily understand the world to see what it might be if through a child's eyes. But I would let him walk someplace, and he wasn't speaking really at the time, just saying short little words and letters. And so he wouldn't be telling me, this is what I see here. Instead, I would just see where he wanted to linger and what he wanted to do and extrapolate what he might be seeing from that. In fact, it's very similar to observing non-human animals, which is what I do professionally, dogs and other animals. You look at their behavior, and then you try to make some inferences about what they might be experiencing.
And I would think as much as looking, he would be touching too. Tactile would be a very big part of the experience.
Oh, you're absolutely right. Yeah, and if I did stop him from all the, you know, all the embraces he
butts.
Would give him. There's some limitations to that looking, but right, he's touching and he's jumping on things and he's not just always standing. Sometimes he'll sit down or he'll get on his knees. And so he's exploring it in a kind of multidimensional way.
Well, from your son going around the block, you next picked up a geologist, Sidney Hornstein, who it was really interesting how he saw everything in Midtown Manhattan as natural. Whether
That's
it's
right.
The asphalt on the street, that, you know, comes from petroleum products and oil products, and everything was either biomass or minerals in his mind.
That's right. So it's living or it's stone. And I had never really thought that geology had a relevance in the city except for where you see some old rock creeping up, you know, through a sidewalk. But, of course, everything is really just made of stones or it's something living. And not only are things made of stones, if you know the names of the stones, that's interesting. I don't know all of those, but he did. But also, you realize that something about the stone tells a history of the object. So the stone might be hundreds of millions of years old, but he can tell that it comes from a particular quarry and, you know, when that building was made, because when was that quarry around, you know? And anyone who's worked with stone or building materials at all would have this kind of perception too. You don't have to be a geologist. And so then you saw that the stone was informative in all these different ways. It's not just a block of buildings. It was a block of buildings that came from different places in the world and arrived here in their current shape at different times, and you could tell that just by the stone.
Yeah, it was almost a geography as much as it was geology, because, you know,
agreed.
It's like, you know, Rhode Island sandstone or Rhode Island granite or Georgia limestone. And he was basically pointing this out as you were walking along.
Yeah, I think he sees this stuff instinctively. You know, that's his brain is entirely changed so that he can't help but see it. Just the way that when we learn language, when you see a written word in front of you, you can't help but read it. You know, there's a time when you're an infant when you don't see that as a word, but now you have to see it as a word, and he has to see the world this way. Now, I didn't get his expertise by walking with him, but I saw that he did have that kind of perception, and he called all of these stones, you know, his friends, basically. He views them as having distinctive identities, and he was enormously charming to walk with.
Now, you walked from the city into Central Park, and it was interesting. He really didn't make a whole lot of distinction between the two, did he?
We see the park as the natural part of the city here in New York, but, of course, it was constructed. It was designed and leveled, and it's made of, you know, it has a lot of rocks popped through it, just like the city does. So it's just, they're cousins. They're not fundamentally different. One has a little more of the biomass than the other.
Yeah, that was a really interesting ascertainment that, you know, well, this was constructed just as those skyscrapers were constructed.
Yeah.
You know, this
and
great lawn or whatever.
There's Manhattan schist, which is a kind of rock that's quite prevalent here, appears in great boulders through the park, but then they were all, sometimes those boulders were also leveled and made into the wall that lines the perimeter of the park. And it was interesting to see that that's basically the same thing, even though as humans, we define those as different. One's natural and one's man-made, but they're not really different.
Hmm. From there, you went on a walk with Paul Shaw, who was a typographer.
Right.
And, of course, in the city, you're surrounded by a cacophony of signs, you know, and he sort of approached the walks the way you would expect a typographer, just trying to absorb every sign around and looking at all the mishmash of fonts and lettering. But I thought the interesting thing was that, you know, signs convey a meaning based on where the sign is. And if you actually take the words off the sign, it doesn't make any sense at all. You know?
Yeah, that's great. That's an interesting observation.
And a lot of times if you're driving down the road and you're just reading signs and not really sort of putting into place, it sounds hilarious because the signs are a collection of words based on what the business type is to let you know what they offer. But if you just read it out loud, it makes no sense at all.
Well, that's a good game to do, actually, as you're driving down the street, isn't it? To realize that all this stuff, you're getting a lot of more contextual information than you realize, as the signs don't have that much logic by themselves. You know, and wherever we go, except for the true wilderness, we're surrounded by words, and every word has to be put into a certain lettering, and somebody made that choice, and it says something about who made that choice, what lettering they use, and, you know, somebody like Shaw could see, basically, he could see who made the choice about the lettering, because it tells you something, just like that, and we're all familiar with this, because we put our documents on the computer in a certain font. So we're making some choice, and we think this represents something serious or something funny or something readable. And apparently we're surrounded by that, and he was pointing that out.
And what were the sort of things that attracted his attention the most? It seemed like it was a hand-lettered sign or a handmade sign.
He was very interested in hand-lettered signs. So the ones which I would think are less fancy or complicated, maybe stenciled signs. He's very interested in no parking signs, which are pretty much everywhere in a city. And so he has a collection of them, right? And any collector also has an interesting kind of attention. Their attention is for that object. They collect teacups or they collect butterflies or something, and they can tell you everything about that type of specimen. They view the world through that prism. And he collects kind of letters, and in particular, no parking signs. So he was really interested in them. And they become more interesting if you just embrace that somebody else has found it fascinating. You know, it doesn't have to be my thing. Then it becomes a little bit of a treasure hunt looking for the next one.
I would imagine you got a lot of insight on these people's personalities by just walking with them and seeing what they were interested in and being the observer in this exercise.
Yeah, there was a lot of interesting observing going on, trying to see what was out there, trying to listen to this person and see who they were. I mean, most of these people were strangers to me, except for my son, before I took a walk with them. So it was an interesting social interaction. I would call somebody up and say, hey, I'm interested in what you see on an ordinary city block. Will you walk with me? And some people, to my infinite surprise, said yes. And, you know, and they showed me. I'm forever grateful to them. But I was also cheered by the fact that so many people, it felt like I could just pick anybody. And if you picked anyone in your life, whether they're a particular expert or not, just has their own life experiences and said, listen, I want you to tell me what you see when we walk together. They're going to see something different than you do, and that's refreshing.
Yeah. My guest today is Alexandra Horowitz, a psychologist and animal behaviorist who teaches at Barnard College at Columbia. She's the author of the bestseller Inside of a Dog, and her latest book is titled On Looking, 11 Walks with Expert Eyes. And it's everything from a naturalist, an animal behaviorist, an urban sociologist, a medical doctor, to some really interesting people that she took walks with. The next one is Mari Kalman, who is an illustrator. And you said that this is a person who has a superhuman ability to transcend the normal urban dwellers' social boundaries. I think that's basically the gist of what you were saying. She really inserted herself in situations that most city dwellers really don't. Push the envelope of what a city dweller would do in meeting strangers, of walking into situations. Must have been a lot of fun, but kind of scary to take the walk with her.
Yeah, a little bit. You exist not just in the city, but anywhere, by staying out of other people's business or space, right? And she didn't violate it exactly, but she would take an opportunity if it were there. If the doors of a church were open, she'd walk in and see what was in that church. And I would hesitate. And it was always interesting to see. And so places that she took a walk with me around my original block, the very first block that I had walked on near where I lived, and we walked in places I had never been, and I'd lived there for years. So that was surprising. She didn't have to go into some fourth dimension to do that. She just walked in as opposed to walking by.
And you actually include two illustrations that she made. One was of a discarded sofa, which I assume happens a lot in New York City. It's just, it gets dumped on the sidewalk. And another of that church you were talking about, where she made an illustration of the poor box that was inside the church. So that was really kind of a cool touch.
Yeah, it was lovely of her to contribute those illustrations. And I think that's part of what she was showing me that she saw. You know, those were the elements to her, the highlights of the walk. Of course, for almost nobody, if they're taking a tour of the city, is a discarded sofa and the poor box in a church. There are those the highlights. But an artist's vision is different. You know, they're seeing things that are overlooked, and I was appreciative that she pointed out those overlooked things to me.
Now I have to talk about the one part of the book where you dealt with senses, and one was, the first one was Arlene Gordon, who is a, well, the best way to put it is, she is a blind world traveler.
Exactly. Very well put.
And she collects souvenirs, and these tactile memories bring back all these memories of travels to China, around the world. And you went on a walk with her.
Yeah, and that was a great walk because I kind of had an idea of what a blind person might experience, but I was wrong, and I'm delighted when I can be so proven wrong so quickly. And she really showed me how much the cane allows her to create a noise which bounces around in a space and lets her see what the space is. And I didn't know that that's how canes worked, and maybe I was naive about that, but then you really see how sound, it's really about sound, how sound changes in different environments, and you get a lot of information about the type of space you're in and who's there even by how the sound bounces towards your ears.
Now, she told you she'd just been on a trip, Storm King. I don't know what that
is. That's right. It's a big outdoor museum up in upper New York.
And she said, I was totally discombobulated. I couldn't catch my orientations because I'd been there before and it seemed so different. And I was thinking of, you know, how she would experience that. Maybe the smells were different. Maybe she was hearing things differently. You know, it was really interesting to hear her talk that way.
Yeah, she experiences it as, she doesn't think she's not seeing something. You know, she travels with people and they give her some visual insight into what is in the environment. In fact, they tell her that they see more because they're forced to articulate for her what they're seeing. So they bother to look as opposed to just scanning a scene. But I think you're right. It feels different in some way, and that's some combination of the smell and the sound and whatever other sensory information she's getting naturally.
Mm-hmm. Now, as you were taking a walk with her, you'd be walking around, and she'd look like she'd veer towards the street, veer towards a building, and you found very quickly, well, that's how she orientates. She has to know where the boundaries are so she can set a course.
Right. I mean, it makes a lot of sense in retrospect, but one's impulse is to guide the person because you think, oh, they cannot see. But that's how she is seeing. And I think there have been studies of people who, people with normal vision, they put a blindfold on them and they set them loose in an empty room. It's not a trick. There are no obstacles or anything. And they just see how they navigate around the room. And people first go right to the wall. You know, you go to find your sort of bearings. And then you see where the walls are, and then you can venture from that. And she just does that much more quickly and elegantly than somebody who's temporarily blindfolded would.
It was interesting, the experience with the awning. She says, we're under an awning, aren't we? And you were a couple feet away from an awning.
Right. And I thought, oh, she's wrong about this. You know, she just can't see it. but I was really wrong. What she was experiencing was how the sound had already started to change. The sound bouncing off of the cane tip in the space around us was already changing a little bit because some of it was bouncing off that underside of the awning and not just flying away. And so she could tell without any visual sense that we were going under an awning, which we wouldn't touch at all, just by the sound. It was just a slightly broader awning than the one I could see.
Mm-hmm. And it was a little longer on each side, yeah, when you left the awning and when you approached it. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, as a musician, I'm interested in sound, and this is something, when I'm outside, a lot of times I'm listening to the world around us, and you actually took a walk with a sound designer, too, Scott
Laird.
Yeah,
so you probably hear a lot of the things that he pointed out on our walk.
A lot of times, yeah. I mean, he mentioned, how tires sound on dry pavement as opposed to wet pavement. There's a very
right.
distinctive sound difference. And it had me thinking about, I remember the days after 9/11, terrible days, but here in the Midwest, when you were outside, everything sounded really, really different.
Mm-hmm.
And it became very quickly apparent. It was because there's this rumble of jets overhead all the time that were no longer there.
Right.
And it was a weird, weird sensation. And it made me think of what he's experiencing on a daily level. There's this sort of din of noise that we don't even know it's there until it's missing.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's very interesting to, instead of just viewing it as noise, which is what you instinctively do when you're in a city because there is so much of it, just to listen to it as sound. And you can do that by trying to identify what the sound is that is there or is missing, as you say, on a weekend. We have a lot less traffic sounds, for instance, where I live. By naming it, then it becomes kind of pleasurable. Then you're collecting the sounds as opposed to just being oppressed by all the noise that's hitting you.
Yeah. My guest today is Alexandra Horowitz. Her new book is titled On Looking, 11 Walks with Expert Eyes. And she followed these people in a variety of professions, from a naturalist looking at bugs and the like, to an animal behaviorist looking at urban animals, to an urban sociologist. That must have been interesting to see all the patterns, you know, that you just think of as everyday getting around the city, and all of a sudden this guy's putting names to it and conditions. Like there was something where a group of unaffiliated people who have just bunched together. That's a platoon.
That's right, right. A platoon of pedestrians crossing the street.
And he explained like when you're getting in the subway, how you can really tell the urban dwellers from the people who are not used to walking about their daily activities.
Right, because the natives, or the people who at least lived in a city for a long time where they're always making little movements to accommodate other people, aren't used to having any space for themselves. So they do a little, what he calls a step and slide, where you kind of curl your shoulder forward instead of leading with your nose and pull your belly in a little bit, and two people slide by each other, making room for two in a space which ordinarily one would fit through. But somebody who lives in a space where there aren't as many, it's not as dense in terms of population, doesn't have to make those little accommodations most of the time, so they just kind of barge on through. And so you can see where somebody is from, basically, by seeing if they make these adjustments.
And they drive like the semi-driver, you know, they walk like the semi-driver. Just,
that's right.
You know, that's like everybody
make a way.
Make a path. Well, it was really interesting. So after these 11 walks, how are you seeing your city differently? How are you seeing your environment differently, hearing your environment differently?
I look a lot more, and I listen too, but mostly it's visual that I just bother to look around me a lot more. I'm looking up more. I notice lots of things on every walk that I take where I bother to open my attention, and I find it very pleasurable to realize that something which was so familiar to me, these blocks where I live, can be made unfamiliar by just turning my attention to one thing, you know, looking at the stones or looking at the leaves or looking at the tree branches. It doesn't even matter what it is, just one kind of thing, and you see the patterns or see divergences or see something new. And I really appreciate that is this kind of vacation vision is available for me right where I live. And so I take advantage of it.
I think that's a really good takeaway, is that, you know, when we are on vacation, we are experiencing the new and trying to take in as much as we can. And when we're in our familiar environment, we tend to block out most of that. Just taking a moment to treat the familiar as new, I think it can be a rewarding experience.
I think so. A lot cheaper than any vacation, too.
Well, the name of the book is On Looking, 11 Walks with Expert Eyes. Everyone from a typographer to a naturalist to an urban sociologist, a medical doctor who you had to try to diagnose, sidewalk diagnose as
right.
People are walking down the street. It's a fun book. Alexandra
Thank
Horowitz,
you.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rich.
Alexandra Horowitz is a cognitive psychologist who teaches at Barnard College at Columbia University and is the author of On Looking, 11 Walks with Expert Eyes. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.